I see a lot of folks here are interested in magic. And this interest has been rather general for a long time. You may probably remember that in about 87 or 86, there came out a new version of the Holy Bible to be read in churches. And in that new edition, this new one just out, it states very firmly that three astrologers saw his star and came to venerate him. Now, this is going to be a blow to somebody, but not much, I don't think. It's really more important to save the civilization than it is to quibble. Now, the astrologers were magi, and the magi of Persia were the source of practically all of the esoteric tradition that drifted into Europe. They were very wise in many things, and their wisdom went back a long way. And among their various achievements were not only astrology and divination, but also a series of very practical discoveries and explanations that will be of service to us today. Three forms of magic were recognized: white magic, a sort of gray-colored magic, and black magic. The magi of Persia were essentially white magicians. They used their arts and their wisdom and their skills for the service of humanity. But like most ancient nations, they had their problems. In the old days, the contact of the human being with his environment was very hazardous. There was no philosophical background to depend on, no regulated theology to lean upon. Each individual had to face the problems of life with whatever courage or insight he possessed. And early in the development of early civilizations, there came around the idea of a medicine priest, a priestly clan, which is perhaps best known for its part in the development of the American Indian structure in North America. It was recognized that there were holy people born with a peculiar gift of some kind. And these holy ones became priests. Now, they were not priests as we would know them now. They were not ordained to a ministry or something. They were priests because they could talk with the olds or with the spirits, or they could see things that others couldn't see, or they could find out where the buffalo were. Such a one was Sitting Bull, who was a medicine priest for his entire lifetime, practically. And all that time he lived with one small tribe, and he predicted for them, and he worked with their sick, and he prepared them for their journey into the afterlife. He even went with them, according to legends, and helped them to make the crossing to that world beyond, where the campfires are in the sky, stars. The priests of that type were an absolutely essential part of civilization. They made it possible. The average person was frightened. He had no securities, no protections, and no insights. He had to depend upon something, and that something was early the medicine priest. Now, the medicine priest, in turn, had to depend upon something. He had to depend either upon the insights which he possessed within his own nature, or make use of symbols and figures and signs and various talismans to enforce his beliefs or teachings. Not very long ago, we noticed in one of our prominent journals a whole page devoted to the classification of available charms that you can buy right now. These charms will do almost everything. They will help you to face the future, or they will take care of housemaid's knee. Whatever you may have, you can get a charm for it. An exposition was made in London, a survey was taken, and 40% of the London school children carried charms with them every day. Now, because we still have the uncertainties, and in these critical times, the uncertainties become more immediate. probably we were never as troubled as we are today, even in primitive times. In those days, we didn't know enough to be troubled as we are now. But we are finding more and more that we are not able to handle the situation. We cannot cope with the skullduggery that is going on in society. And the average person, like the average primitive human being, must seek some solace, some consolation, and some source of inner strength. Out of that came the most interesting of all art, perhaps, fetish art. Art to convey to the individual a certain strength due to its own designs. The Egyptians were masters of fetish art. So were the Gnostics. Most of the Oriental people are strongly developed in it. It is to carry something, have something, say something, know words or formulas by means of which you can meet unexpected emergencies. Now, the attainment of this type of security is, of course, open to considerable psychological speculation. It's very possible that the fact that we believe in the charm gives it an efficacy, that we believe in it and we gain a strength from our believing. We support a weakness in our own nature and are able to face things a little better or a little more securely than we could without this symbolical help. Now, objects around the people of old days were used for making such charms. The turquoise charms of the American and Central American Indians also drifted into Tibet and were used for all sorts of medical, spiritual, ethical problems. We also noticed another peculiarity. Nothing in its native state is magical. It has to have something done to it so that it becomes something different. And I saw a very good example of that on Navajo Reservation. Two little stones, about the size of a nickel each, were very pretty little stones. The children played with them. But then came the time when something was necessary. A new charm had to be fashioned. So the two little stones were laid one on top of the other, and a loop of rawhide was put around to hold them together. Immediately, they were not two little stones anymore. Now they had the power of the olds, the powers of the trues, the powers of the goods. By carrying that little charm around, you gain some kind of spiritual strength or consolation. You were able to face the day with greater bravery. And if it's happened that you were going into battle, you felt you had a greater chance of survival. Charms of this kind and fetishes were very, very common in Europe. In the days of the great crusades, there were a great many pilgrims that went to the Far East and Near East in search of religious consolation. All the way along the line, there were dangers. And many of these pilgrims wore symbolic forms or figures in their hats to protect them. They began by using gold or silver medals attached to the hat, but many of them were held up and killed for the gold medals, so they became finally merely paper symbols. But if you had that on your hat, you had a better chance of getting to Jerusalem. And you probably had no actually better chance, but you approached life with a greater positive sense of strength. So the charm and the fetish were strength symbols. They helped us to go on and do things we did not believe to be possible. In medicine, it's the placebo. It is a little capsule of nothing but ground white flour. If you take it, it'll cure all kinds of diseases that you do not have. You think you have them? So this helps you. Everywhere there is a magical value in the unknown. There is something that, if you can visualize it as useful or helpful, can do wonderful things. This is the secret of holy relics. No one knows how efficacious they really are, but that they have resulted in miraculous circumstances cannot be denied. We do not know just how the healings of Lourdes and Sanan de Beaupré are achieved. But certainly, the belief is important. The charm, their symbolism, the prayer, and a physical action to make all these things into one pattern gives the individual a strength that he does not otherwise possess. Now, white magic in its essential form must be virtuous. White magic is that which serves without hurting. It is that which accomplishes good and is never used for any other purpose. White magic is the use of the powers of life, the powers of nature, and even the ordinary faculties of the mind for the perpetuation of constructive imagery. It is necessary, therefore, that all white magic, in order to retain its nature, must be backed by a strong moral character. This is something that has been very common throughout Asia, where most of the dedicated mendicants, the holy men, have achieved a kind of white magic by gaining complete control over their own minds, their own emotions, and their own actions. These people, to remain white magicians, would under no conditions pervert, corrupt, or compromise the principles which they hold sacred. Therefore, a life dedicated to certain spiritual principles gains also a strength. And this strength can be considered as magical because it involves faculties that cannot be completely classified. No one can be sure what happens, but if something does happen, then in some mysterious way, an energy that resides in nature is made available to the human being. And it is generally known and widely respected that where dedication results in a greater interior enlightenment, the individual does perform heroic services for mankind. So white magic is the use of every power that we know for the service of good. It is the ability to learn but never abuse what is learned. And it is that the highest of all learning is that which is dedicated to unselfish purposes. White magic is not used to help oneself. It is assumed, however, that properly used for other purposes, it brings with it a security of the inner self. The individual who serves gradually gains the realization that a divine power in himself is making this service possible. And it is this divine power which then becomes the leader of his life. In this way, we have a great many very wonderful examples of dedication, and the fact that these dedications, in their turn, have contributed tremendously to the advancement and survivals of civilized orders and peoples. Now, in white magic, therefore, the individual must realize that the principal energy upon which he depends is not his own. The energy is within himself. It is a soul power. It is a divine energy within himself. And any use that he makes of this divine energy must be worthy of its source, the light of God and the light of truth. If this is perverted and the individual becomes self-centered and turns these energies for the advancement of his own purposes, he goes against the statement long made, others him he could help, but himself he could not save. Therefore, the individual who uses the divine power is forbidden by the law itself to use it for himself. But by using it for others, he reaps a virtue within himself. Always the motive becomes the basis of the difference between these various types of discipline. If the motive is personal, the achievement is much lower and much less permanent than where it is for the service of something greater than self. Now, in the life of the average person growing up today, there is an unfortunate lack of nearly any idealistic structure capable of dominating conduct. Small children are not taught that conduct is of great importance to them. They drift along under some circumstances reasonably well, other times not so well. Some are miserably neglected and left to develop the best they can. The condition of children today is very poor, generally speaking. On the other hand, the individual, the parent, should understand the responsibilities of his own office. A parent who leaves children to be neglected is injuring himself far more than he could possibly do by some obvious act of delinquency. We have to use the divine powers that are given to us to serve the divine needs of our fellow men. We must use them as they were intended to be used, not to make life more comfortable for ourselves, but to make life more important for those in great need. We have today a world in great need. We have hundreds of millions of people on the verge of starvation. Therefore, it becomes particularly unfortunate in these days to use the needs, sorrows, miseries, and sufferings of other people as the basis of improving our own economic condition. This is not good white magic. White magic is also the development of the love principle. Actually, as Plato pointed out, the end of all wisdom is to understand faith. It is to understand the real, deep relationship between the human being and his creator. And this relationship is divine love. And this divine love is transmitted from generation to generation and from level to level of culture to become the basis of personal and impersonal affection. There is love of God, love of country, love of beauty, love of family. There are all kinds of affections, but they are all, to a wager, magical. Love is one of the great magical powers because it transforms the individual in whom it is real. When we really love someone, we cannot abuse them, we cannot cheat them, we cannot do things to them which will be to their detriment. Therefore, love carries with it sacrifice for a cause, sacrifice for a loved person, sacrifice for love of God, sacrifice for love of country. Always love is unselfish. And as far as it is unselfish, it is white magic. If it becomes selfish, it turns gray, and if it is selfish enough, it will turn black. But in the normal, proper way of things, it should be just a little off-white. Occasionally, we can be excused for a minor slip into something of a personal nature, maybe a little too much so. But for the benefit of the world in general, a person who loves truly is an asset to his world and is strengthening himself above any discipline that he might take to improve his character. So we have now the basis of white magic: service, sacrifice, and dedication. We have the individual using the power of God for the good of man, using the mysterious resources of the universe to make life happier and safer for those who live with us and for those who come after us. This means that a true white magic has to be the result of a considerable internal insight. The individual must really and surely believe that the energies, resources, powers, and integrities that he possesses were given to him to use for a common cause. He is to be better not for his own sake alone, but for the world in which he lives. And if he becomes better, his world immediately improves. There is a mysterious magic here also. The complainer always lives in a poor world. But as he rises above his own limitations and transmutes his own attitudes, he suddenly finds the world is a lot better than he thought it was. Always white magic is the power to see good and to grow and to do things more effectively for the sake of humanity in general. Now we go to the opposite end of this and see what we can do with black magic. Black magic is another factor we've had with us from the time of the Greeks, Romans, Persians, and Hindus. Black magic has always been a source of fear, a source of dread. It has controlled people by terrorizing them. It has controlled individuals by threatening them with psychic forces or for psychic disasters. At one time, I knew a case in which an individual was nearly frightened to death because he belonged to an organization which he finally discovered was not what it ought to be, and he asked to resign and decided to resign.
and he was told by a member of the organization that if he tried to resign or left them, he would be magically destroyed. He survived it, but it was a bad time for a while. Sorcery is also black magic. In old days, sorcery was often a black magician making a circle in the earth at the crossroads of two main highways, standing in the midst of his circle and invoking spirits with magic charms. Another favorite spot for this type of activity was the local graveyard. It was always assumed that the ghosts and the spirits were available, and most of the ghosts and spirits that appear in the old books are rather unpleasant looking figures. Some of them are actually rather terrifying if you want to accept them literally. But it is also true that these spirits and these ghostly things were part of a way of controlling people. They were terrorizing many individuals, and even today among primitive people, or semi-primitive people, this terrorizing continues. It is the individual held from the freedom of his own life by fear, by anxiety, by the belief that someone has power to destroy him. Many years ago, in several countries, there was a form of mentalism developed in which individuals took lessons in how to influence other people's thinking. All you had to do was sit very quietly, meditate, say certain holy names, and turn the attention to this distant person whom you wish to influence, and force them to make the changes that you can cause them to make by the use of magic. That went along quite a while, and exponents did pretty well for themselves. And of course the teachers did very well for themselves, as they always do under those conditions. And then came the deluge. Suddenly, these people who were out influencing others realized that others could be influencing them at the same time. And that was all different. We wished to influence other people to do what we want, but we didn't want them to influence us to do what they want. And so that whole group of nervous breakdowns resulted, in which individuals were frightened to death that others were using on them what they had been trying to use on each other. So this gradually faded out. It wasn't so good anymore. It became obvious that all over influence can work both ways. And when it starts to work in reverse, it loses its interest, but comes a source of greater fear and anxiety. Black magic is represented in a heavy literature called grimoires. These are little penny productions, most of them forgeries, accredited to great teachers of the past. One is the grimoire of St. Augustine, another is the grimoire of St. Thomas Aquinas, then there is a grimoire of Aristotle. All different names of famous people have been put on books made up of funny magical characters that don't spell anything and in languages nobody can read, but were supposed to carry charms for the control of spirits. And in the black magic societies, it was assumed that there was an infernal equivalent to the divine hierarchy. As there was a god, though there was a devil. As this god was served by all kinds of angels and archangels and thrones and dominations and powers, so the infernal god was served by all forms of evil beings. And one such evil being, of course, is the hero in Faust's story about Mephistopheles. But anyway, these evil spirits became a hierarchy, and lessons were given in it, and in doing these things, and many famous people are believed to have signed pacts with fallen angels to have all the powers of the world for a certain length of time, and they lose their own souls. One who signed such a pact, according to pretty solid tradition at least, was Oliver Cromwell. And the pact ended on a certain day, and so did he. So that all these things are part of a great cycle of mystery. Now, black magic is dedicated to the concept of power without retribution. It is based upon the idea that it is possible for the human being to conceive and design and invent all kinds of mysterious things for unworthy purposes. It is possible for him to gather wealth by unfair action. And always with these things were little scribbles, little lines of mysterious characters in Greek or Hebrew or Sanskrit or Phoenician or something that nobody could read. Now this kind of brings something to mind that we don't think of very much. What are the great magical alphabets of today? Mathematics. All those formulas on the blackboards, on the institutes of technology, a mysterious abracadabra understood only by those who have been students of the subject. But out of these strange combinations of figures, numbers, various variations, come all kinds of strange things. From the studies of physics and biology and chemistry, there has developed a tremendous number of very strange and not necessarily very wonderful things. Remember now that the motive is the purpose, is the principal factor. Where a thing is done to help mankind, it is right. Where it is done to profit only individuals, or is made to damage some at the expense of others, it is black magic, regardless of whether it is on the level of banking or on the level of agriculture. Motive lies behind everything. If the motive is not basically good, then the individual gets into trouble. Many years ago, I was talking with a physicist from the University of Berkeley on their researches in nuclear weaponry. And I asked him how he slept at night as being part of this program. And he said very simply, he said, "Well, we don't have no responsibility. We invent, we don't use. If we invent it and somebody else abuses it, it's their fault, not ours. If they want to use it for war instead of for peace, we can't help it. The possibility of preventing it in the first place never occurred to him." But years ago, several prominent physicists retired rather than to go on into the type of armament that is based upon those funny little figures that look almost exactly like some of the magical characters in the black magical books of the Middle Ages. So here we have now skill. We have the ability to invent. And we think of progress in terms of invention. We are so proud of landing somebody on the moon that we can hardly wait to get them onto Mercury. We are so proud of the television that we never give a thought as to what comes over it. We are very proud of the nuclear fission and all that has to do with it. Now we're gaining an inordinate pride over all these computers that we are using for one purpose or another. Nobody, however, gives any thought to the misuse of these things. Once they are invented, you can't take it back. The Egyptians and the Greeks had a lot of knowledge of these subjects, but they gave this knowledge only to initiated members of their esoteric bodies, and they held those initiates under the strongest obligations. One single slip of the tongue could cost the initiate his life if he was dedicated to the service of the temple. For his antiquity, it wasn't what you discovered, it's how you used it that determined what kind of a person you are. It wasn't the fact that you were famous because you discovered something. You were famous because you contributed to the common good. That it was a better world because you had lived in it. If that's true, you had a right to have a statue in one of the present public buildings. But not simply because you discovered a better weapon with which to kill somebody else. So black magic is the abuse of knowledge, the abuse of the energies of life, the perversion of the principles of science, medicine, law, or religion. Black magic is the use of those values which are divinely available to us, for purposes contrary to the will of God and the need of humanity. And where this happens, there's going to be trouble. There's going to be trouble because you can't break rules without hurting yourself in the long run. So here we now have a world which is largely dominated by the abuse of privilege, energy, and opportunity. We have a world made up of people who do not care what the consequences are. The only thing they want to do is to make an unreasonable profit over what they discover. And, narcotics addicts are perfectly willing to buy their necessary drugs by making new addicts. They don't care. But they're laboring in a universe which is not very kindly to those types of attitudes. Somewhere, the disaster happens. We cannot abuse privileges without ultimately suffering physically, morally, mentally, spiritually, and also bringing down our own civilizations in ruin. So the black magicians now probably are mostly in the fields of higher learning. We have an occasional black magician who tries to become smart, has a little circle and a few followers, but doesn't amount to too much. But these great black magicians, these great economic speculators, these tremendous perverters of knowledge, these are the things that worry us, because we are given things without being given any wisdom to use them. What have we done with these things, and why do we talk about progress? Why do we say that we are the highest intelligent creation that ever existed? Simply because we are scattering death about the world. Why do we insist upon thinking that there is no responsibility for our conduct? It may be true that the laws of the nation cannot reach us, but the universal law will not forget us. And when the time comes, it will do what is necessary to correct some of this condition. Actually, therefore, I think our main problem is to transform certain black magic into white magic, if we can. White magic is usage. White magic is direction of usage. We are not dealing in white magic when we sell to anyone who wants to buy nuclear weapons. We are only actually serving the universe where we transmute these nuclear weapons into plowshares and start using, instead of abusing, the resources of life. This is true everywhere. We are abusing the resources which have been given to us, which would be adequate for us if our own selfishness didn't destroy us. So black magic, in fact and reality, is the use of power to hurt. It is the use of position to enslave. It is to use education as an instrument of industry rather than enlightenment. It is a country which passes laws that are inappropriate to the needs of the people. And most of all, it is an example which we give to those around us of the abuse of divine privileges. Just as a neglected human being is a blot upon the memory of nature, so this constant abuse and misuse is a constant cause of sorrow and misery to all concerned. White magic is use. Gray magic is, say, misuse. Black magic is abuse. And these things will come back to roost. They always do. So we look around and we say, what are these wonderful, gracious gifts for which we are congratulating each other? Well, actually, we do not need to canonize the inventor of television at the moment. Their contribution to our enlightenment is mostly pathetic and apathetic. And being what we are, most people will not support anything better, because they have no background for it. And why have they no background? Education has been used only to create selfish people. Our whole civilization is geared to concepts of gray and black use of the gifts and powers and privileges that we have received from nature. We are misusing knowingly. We know when we are taking narcotics. We know when we're alcoholics. But we do not realize that there is something in us that is just getting into serious trouble. We think it'll all end at the grave, that we'll all go to sleep with the ages and no one will know whether we ever lived or not. This is a really, to some, is a pessimistic view, but to a great number, it is an optimistic view. They definitely hope that their own careers will never catch up with them. But this is a false hope. In nature, everything has its payments. Everything must be solved correctly. So we say the old black magic was the time when they created various demons, where they burned cows at the stake because they were enchanted. And there they put people up in the Inquisition and sentenced them to be burned at the stake or broken on a rack simply because they were godly old people with bad memories. All of these things were looking after the smaller crimes. There was a great fuddle in Germany at one time when a cow went dry, and practically all the citizens of the community were blamed for it, and one or two actually lost their lives. All this to try to make it sound nice and ornery and even and correct. It all is part of a strange negative magic that has enveloped the human mind or has tainted it with all kinds of ulterior explanations. No one is seemingly wanted to accept the simple fact: we are in trouble because we deserve it. This is the last thing we want. And because we do not want to face into the causes of our own difficulties, we have developed a new kind of magic, which we might term, for general purposes, just plain gray magic. Gray magic is doing some small thing right in order to get away with something bigger that we don't want to have right. It is a partial conversion. Now, every evangelist in the olden days knew what these partial conversions were. The individual came down the sawdust track, in great humility, wailing with mishaps that were happening to him, accepting blame for everything he'd ever done, and praying for forgiveness. So he got an absolution from the missionary, and it seemed to be fine. The next year he came down the path again with exactly the same problem. I used to know some retired missionaries over here in Pomona, and some of them had actually converted the same person 10 or 15 times. The conversion never stuck, because the person only got a repentance for a little while, but no basic change in nature. He didn't want to offend God, no. But he didn't think God would mind if he offended everybody else. And he was perfectly qualified to be slack in his labor, to overcharge for his products, to mismanage his home, neglect his children, and increase his bank account. This was all that counted, and that and a good religious life. But there was no good religious life under such circumstances. So the conversions didn't hold. Now, there are people all over the world today who are studying various forms of mysticism, metaphysics, idealistic philosophy, oriental doctrines, and American Indian medicine principles, all kinds of things. And the studies are good. It's not important whether anybody else agrees with us or not. The real problem is, do we really basically do the thing we believe to be right? But as the time goes on, we find that these people do have the same problems as the relapsed sinner has, that they keep right on studying these things. That's fine. But using what they learn is a little grimy at times. They keep right on doing the selfish things because they must not allow a spiritual conversion to interfere with a financial career. That's just not possible. If you can make a sharp bargain, you can put a new stained glass window in some church and be regarded as virtuous, But inside of your soul, the truth is always there. The motives behind what we do make for black or white. If the motive is for show, that's wrong. If it's an apology for conduct which is not corrected afterwards, it's wrong. If it's to advance personal position, fame, get into public office, all wrong. That's why we have such poor public officials. It's because the official is judged by his academic standing or his political standing, but not by his moral insights. Unless a person is good, you'll never be a good leader. And a country or a world that depends upon bad people because they are a little smarter will be in trouble to the end. There are laws governing these matters, and these laws are innumerable and immutable. So we have to begin to think in our own lives some of these things that constitute magic, the magic of hope, the magic of faith, the magic of love. These are all beautiful things, but if they are perverted, they immediately drop into black magic. The moment selfishness takes over a career, its virtues fade out. The moment the person puts his own advantage first, or tries to use something he knows and possesses to humiliate or humble some other person, all of this is used against him. Though they might say, how is it used against him? After all, one of these days he's going to depart, and nobody knows where he came from, and nobody knows where he goes. And for most people, nobody cares. But the individual must prove to himself that he does not survive, or all this thinking is not much good. If there is life after death, and the general consensus of opinion is that it is probable, there are only two ways in which we think of it, either as punishment or as reward. In black magic, the punishment is clearly shown. Every black magician must end by being dumped into the hell of his own devising. Every black magic formula, when its virtues are exhausted or its powers are limited, becomes the beginning of eternal damnation. The black magician doesn't labor from any false understanding. He knows that he's going to be like Faust in the story. He's going to have 20 or 25 years of the good life, and then he's going to be turned over to eternal punishment. Now, this is an interesting thought. Nobody much probably care much about that today. But what about narcotics? The individual who is in drugs is going to have highs and big moments for a few years, and then he's going to become a complete wreck. And no one knows what's going to happen to him after he leaves here. He is doing everything for this one great high. Well, that is very common in black magic. The success of the moment, the wealthy marriage, the big settlement, the tremendous raise of price of values, all these things are the big highs for which nearly everyone works. Nobody seems to pay any attention to the deep lows. When it comes to the low, the individual is assumed to gradually disappear, and we don't hear of him anymore about him. But the old process goes on just the same.